Give glory to God, our light and our life.
You're listening to the recordings of sessions from the Institute on Liturgy, Preaching, and Church Music in July of 2024, hosted by Concordia University, Nebraska. If you'd like to learn more about past LCMS worship institutes or about those that might be coming soon, visit lcms.org/worship-institute.
You want to cut to the last page? Perfect. So this is the final page. Okay. How many of you are familiar with Jan Bender as a composer, musician? So he actually taught here at Concordia Seward from, I believe, 1960 to 1965. Is that correct? And you studied this piece with him during that time here. So I'm going to preface by saying you have more firsthand experience working with Jan on this piece than I do. So take everything that I say with a grain of salt. but I do want to share a little bit of background about Jan Bender's training and style, because I think it informs some of the decisions that we can make as performers in this music. So, are you familiar with the work of the German composer Hugo Distler? Has anybody played Distler, or you've heard his choral works? Distler was Jan Bender's composition teacher and, you know, a primary musical influence on Bender. So I think if we understand some of Hugo Distler's musical influences and interests as a composer, it can shed some light on how we can approach Bender's compositions, both this piece as well as some of his other keyboard works. Hugo Distler was associated with a period that we now know as the Orgelbewegung, or kind of the Baroque revival in the early 20th century. So there was this generation of composers in Germany, as well as other parts of Europe, that were interested in recovering some of the ideals of Baroque music, as opposed to the sort of late Romantic, you know, maximalism that we might see in the works of composers like Strauss, Mahler, and so forth. So there was this emphasis now on things like using modality, maybe using clearer, transparent textures, you know, using newer ideas for how you could be metrically and rhythmically expressive in your compositions with the keyboard. And for organ compositions, this was also coupled, of course, with changes in the philosophy of organ building. So we went from the typical late German Romantic organ, where you have a very foundation-based approach to sound, very orchestral, and designed to create these large contrasts of dynamic, but without really using things like mixtures and plenum choruses, to organ builders in that period now trying to build organs that in some ways recovered what they saw as the ideals of Baroque organ building, where you have like clearly defined principal choruses on different divisions and so forth. So, you know, it's hard to understand this music without also thinking in terms of both these compositional ideas, but also how the organs of that time influence this music. So let's turn to this opening, Trudy. Can we, you're on the first page?
Yeah.
Okay. Now I would like to challenge you, just, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but would you be comfortable actually playing this pedal line at the beginning on the manuals instead, just so you can, and you could play it with your right hand since that might be most comfortable. I would like to suggest that we go with a larger, brighter registration.
Okay.
So, you know, think of the Preludia tradition that we see in Buxtehude and Bach. These pieces often end or begin with these sort of improvisatory flourishes, which, you know, are usually played on the full organ when you dig into the sources for how these pieces were played and everything. And I think that the opening of this piece is very much echoing that sort of gesture. Just think, for example, of the pieces that begin with pedal solos in the Baroque literature, like the Bach Toccata Adagio and Fugue in C major. Buxtehude 137 with the big pedal solo at the beginning of it. So let's see if we can capture something of that style here, shall we? So I'm going to put on the full mixture chorus here on the grate, and let's actually couple the positive chorus to it as well. On this organ, we don't really have a mixture chorus available on the Re C, so let's not worry about that.
I wanted to share something about Jan Bender.
Yes.
He always said, Americans are so lazy. They hop all over the organ with one foot.
Uh-huh.
I want you to play pieces well.
Yeah, yeah. Let's come back to the pedaling in just a second, but I want to start with sort of, you know, ways of interpreting this line so it really captures this sort of vitality and you know, something of the text here at the beginning of this. So could I suggest, now, you guys can't see this, but the beginning of it's written in a triple meter. And we have this rhythm of da-dum-bum-ba-da-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum. And in general, the notes are slurred together within each beat. So could we actually start with that? Da-dum-bum-ba-da-dum-bum-ba-dum. Very good. Now, notice here the pattern breaks a little bit, so it actually slurs into that. And I like the way that you had the little break and you played this more detached, but could you try just detaching that note only? So maybe break right here where the slur ends. Sorry. like that. Yeah, yeah, more like that. Now the thing is, we're in a very resonant space like this, so playing it with the pure legato like we're doing it right now, that might actually be a little too legato for this much sound. But I think that idea of thinking, here's the stuff that needs to sound more connected, and then here's this note that needs to sound more detached, that's the important thing. So can you now try playing it slightly detached for the places where it's indicated with slurs, but then the notes that are detached, like right there, think more like a staccato. Try it within the slur. Yeah, you're used to doing it one way, so I'm putting you on the spot. Yes, yeah. Yes, very good. So you hear how that already has more vitality where we began. So it's a combination of using this larger registration, observing the phrasing that's actually in the music, but also just adjusting our touch to account for things like the size of the acoustic here, as well as the registration. Now, could you try doing just that part with your feet? And you can take it a little bit slower if you want to, but I want you to see if you can take that same touch that you had just now and do the same with your feet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, take it a little bit slower so you can think about it. Yeah. So a change of pedaling might help here. It looks like you have your heel indicated there, is that? Or is that another toe?
No, I was taking the left foot.
Could you actually try right here on that D? Could you try your right heel? Take it very slow so you can do this. But I think that will. Yeah, and okay, then just, okay. So you can practice releasing that. Sure. Yeah, but that's the right idea. Yeah, so continue to play that D with your left foot.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the right idea. So you can refine that, but I think having this larger registration and then just thinking carefully about the phrasing that's indicated there, but also how to bring out a little more vitality here. I know, that can be a big change, too. So let's go to this passage now where the manuals enter. And so the way this is written, Bender indicates that the left hand is on the first manual, and then the right hand, which has this more florid ornamental part, is on the second manual. So we can make some choices about how to do this. I would interpret that as a similar sound, but we probably want the primary manual to be a little bit more prominent.
Okay.
So let's, I might adjust the registration here a little bit, but could you try this with your right hand on the positive, your left hand on the grave? And I know this is not how you've practiced it, so this is going to feel backwards. But take it as slow as you need to. Yeah, good. So what I would suggest is, for that passage in the right hand with those rapid 16th notes, I would work out your fingerings there. There's a couple of scale passages, and we can just use standard scale patterns for that. But notice within those, there's also some slurred notes, not as many as you had during the pedal solo. So maybe for the first part of this, play it with a slightly more open touch, just so that we have more contrast for the notes that are slurred. Sorry. And so forth. Do you want to try a little bit of that like that? So, let's just do the right hand. Let me play it for you one more time. We'll just do these two beats. Yeah, good. Now, could you try that with the left hand? And that was very good. But I think what we'll notice when you hear all of that together is that those notes that are now longer because she's playing them with more of the legato touch, they sort of pop out of the texture. So I have this interesting effect where we hear the detached 16th notes are not quite as prominent in the texture, but then you hear this da-da-dum, ba-da-dum, kind of bouncing around. You ready? Yep. And I would keep that right in time at the end. Da-da-da-da-da-dum, bum-bum-ba. Very good. So a lot of the same material repeats through this section. So could we actually go to the last page now, since that has some different musical things going on? But you can take a lot of what we've talked about and worked on here and just apply it to that section. Okay. So, you know, again, if you think about this basic preludia structure, they typically end with this big outburst on the organ, often very free writing. If it's based on a chorale or something like that, we might have some sort of at least fragmentary restating of some of the core material. So I think Bender, again, is thinking very much within these historical models from Baroque music and Baroque practice. So can we start here? And again, let's go with the fuller registration here. I might actually add a little bit to what we had, just so you have the sense of the weight of this passage. We can add a read or something. You ready? And play on the grave. Yeah, there you go. Yep. Can we stop there for a second? So I think one of the things I'd like to hear in this is just more of a sense of weight when you get to these quarter notes, but at the same time, I would actually break a little bit more and see if you can keep it consistent across all of the quarter notes. So for example, Trudy, right here, I know you just learned that, but think more like. But you hear, especially in this acoustic, that it has this heft to it, but also a lot of rhythmic and metrical clarity. And I think for this sort of music, that's always a priority. So could you? Let's just take this and just the manual part, but think like, yes, good. And I really appreciate at the when you release those chords, you're releasing all of the voices at exactly the right time. And that will give you a really clean sound, especially with this sort of texture and registration. Now, can we do the same thing again once more and then go on into this next measure? Let's try it one more time. Don't worry about the pedal for now. And see if you can just keep the time solid through here and go a little bit slower if you need to. Okay. Good. So we talked about these big quarter note chords. You sort of have this quasi toccata figuration that's thrown in here. And you guys can't see the score, but the right hand is playing these open fifths and 16th notes. Right, so, but it's helpful for everybody to understand what's going on here in the manual. So, in the left hand, you have a held note, but also in the left hand, you have these moving eight notes. Like that, and then the right hand is just doing this in this measure. So it's, you know, similar to what we might see in a typical toccata, where there's some sort of perpetual motion figure or device that's happening. But around it, we might have some notes that are sustained. We have parts that are moving at a slower rate and are a little more melodic. So we want to get all of these things lined up with each other and in the right proportion so that this sounds right. So Trudy, could we do just the left hand here? And so you're right, you'll sustain that C all the way through. Can you play the eighth notes just a little bit more open? I wouldn't worry about playing them legato. Yes, for this, I think you can play that all in your left hand. Yep. So don't be afraid, Trudy, to break these notes when they're done. So, for example, rather than playing those first couple legato. You can play those first ones detached too. Yeah. Good. Now, I would sort of split the difference. I thought that was perhaps a little more towards the staccato side. So could you think, I don't know if you've ever tried this exercise, but take one finger, and I want you to play a scale. But play a scale with one finger, but keep it as legato as you can. Yeah. See if you can keep it even a little more connected. And use a nice curved finger, just as you regularly would. Yeah. Can you play the notes longer? You're adding more space between the notes than I am. That's more space than you had before. Can you reduce the amount of space? Watch me do it once more. But this is a good way just to calibrate your ears to the amount of space that's going to make sense in this passage. So think that you're playing it legato, but you're playing it legato with only one finger. So you have to physically break. But try it, Trudy. By just doing the scale of work. That's getting there. Now, same thing, one finger. Play it legato, or as close as legato to legato as you can get. Yes, that's the sound. So, do you guys hear the difference? So this is an exercise that I do with almost every single one of my students because it calibrates your ear to this slightly open touch. And it's not a staccato touch, it's not a legato touch. You can control the amount of space between these notes, but this sort of like gets you to the place where you hear what that minimum space is. And depending on the acoustic and the registration, how responsive the organ is, this can feel different on different instruments. But it's a great way of just getting that sound in your ears so you can play it. Now that you've heard that sound, this is the last thing we're going to do on this. Can you get that sound in these moving eighth notes? Even though we're using all of your fingers now. That's it. Yep. So to make this easier, release this C right at the end of this measure. Good. Yep. Last thing we'll do, can you put this all together right here so we hear it? And the right hand, just very open touch, very brilliant. Yes. Good. Good. Yeah, that's good. So those heavy quarter notes, but with the separation like you had, and then in these staccato-like passages, just think of, you know, keeping things a little bit more open. Listen for all of these different layers, the 16th notes, the 8th notes, and so forth. But I think you'll find that you get a much more robust sound. Yeah, and that's, I mean, again, very much in line with the style of this music and Baroque performance practice and so forth, so. Yeah, I thought it was great. So thanks for being such a good sport. I really appreciate it. So, thank you, Trudy. Yeah. Yeah, I'd say you're on track for it. She said her goal is to have that ready for Easter of next year. So I'd say you're well on your way. All right, Sarah, the Franck. I'm the same way, so. Do you want me to turn pages for you? Okay. Let's start at the beginning, and then I'd say let's go maybe midway into the middle section. Okay. She's playing a portion of the prelude from the prelude variation, prelude fugue and variation of 1868. So it's a fairly early work for Franck. point if we stopped it. All right, very good. So. Good. So I know we talked about this last night, but about how long have you been working on this piece? 8 months, but not kind of on and off. Yeah. So some significant time off from the piece in that. So, and this is the first piece of Franck that you've played? Yeah. Have you played any other French Romantic literature? Okay. So this is, I mean, beyond just moving into a new piece, it's really a new style as well. So, but you have played some Baroque works. I know we talked about like the Bach Eight Little Preludes and Fugues yesterday. Yeah. So this is great. So I want to focus a little bit more on some ideas about the style of this piece. I know, especially for the first section, you seem pretty confident in the notes. But the interpretation of pieces like this is quite different from what we encounter with Baroque music, so that's a good use of our time today. Do you listen to a lot of like classical chamber music, symphonic music? Okay, so put on your composer hat for a moment. If I asked you to rescore this piece as a chamber piece for instruments, what instruments would you choose for your ensemble? So bass, viola, and violin. Yeah, I think it would work beautifully like that. I might go with cello instead of bass, or you could have cello and bass together. But you know, I think this idea of like a chamber music-like texture in this section of the piece is a really helpful way of understanding this work. So you know, many of these things are baked in already. It's very transparent. It's not a big, thick texture. But I think if we can think more in the way that instruments might interpret some of these long flowing melodies and how they might shape them dynamically and rhythmically, then it will give you some insights into how you can interpret this at the organ as well. So let's start with the melody, shall we? Do you mind, that oboe is a little bit out of tune and it's a little bit distracting in some of the places where it clashes. So could we actually use a slightly different registration? I want to just find a nice mellow solo sound that you can use, and then we'll just use a soft flute to accompany. So can we actually try the principal on the grate as your solo? It'll be a little bit fuller, but I think a little more vocal and in tune with everything else. So can we start with just the melody that's in your right hand? Good. So something that's really integral to Franck's melodic style, and this is true of many other composers as well, is that there's a lot of repetition within this melody. But when things repeat, they often repeat in either a rhetorical way. It's like when I tell my kids, go clean your room, go clean your room, and then go clean your room, right? So sometimes when we repeat things, we use a different sort of emphasis on it. But it's also common with Franck for things to change slightly in terms of the pitches when things repeat. So let's go back to the beginning. Where do you see some repetition happening here? Yeah, so measures 1 and 2 are exactly the same. How can you make those measures different from each other? In a musically rhetorical way. Yeah, so let's experiment with this a little bit, shall we? What I might suggest is, let's look for where this repetition starts at the beginning of the second measure. If we can change something slightly there, like maybe the way that we're shaping the time or the notes that we're choosing to accent, you know, where we're lingering a little bit or using an agogic, that might help to bring out that difference for the listener. And it's very similar to what a skilled instrumentalist, like the violinist that you chose for your chamber music, the arrangement of this, would do naturally. So. Like there's sort of a slight lingering on the D, but it just sort of casts this repetition in a slightly different light already. Can you try that? Good. Yeah. So you can experiment with this, and you know, the interpretation of Franck can be highly individualistic. So if you listen to 10 different people play this piece, they will probably play those two measures 10 different ways. And that's okay. I think the important thing is to really listen carefully to what's going on and achieve a musical result. and you know, we can do different things throughout this piece, so you don't have to do it the same way every time those phrases start. Now, into that second measure, what happens? Yeah, so now we sort of reach up to this high note. Now, have you listened to a lot of like opera or art song, especially 19th century music? Okay, so you would probably recognize this effect. When you hear like opera singers singing in a beautiful bel canto style, typical of 19th century art song and opera and so forth, you'll often sort of place notes, especially high notes. You might use a little bit of a glissando to get up to those notes, like da, or something like that, as opposed to just going da, da. Makes sense. And vocally, that's a very natural thing to do. Instrumentalists do exactly the same thing. So your violinist in your hypothetical ensemble, they would probably do exactly that. Let's find a way of doing that on the organ too. Now, what I would suggest is when you have that F sharp going up to the D, keep it very legato just as you did, but can you actually linger on the F sharp a little bit more? Because it's gonna sort of... Now, if I, even a touch of over legato, but be careful not to overdo it, but if I linger on that F sharp, you hear how it sounds like I'm really carefully placing that note, but it suddenly sounds much more expressive. So start at the second measure, and let's go on into the third measure now. Still just the melody. Stretch. Yes, beautiful. Did you guys hear the difference? Yeah, it just instantly comes to life, and it sort of, especially at the beginning of this piece, for me, it establishes that the parameters of this piece are going to be much more flexible and much more expressive and romantic than if we take these first couple of measures and we just sort of play it very metrically and very strictly. So, you know, it's a combination of a couple of different things, really thinking about the legato. You know, be careful not to get bogged down in these agogic accents, but when you want it, that's a great tool to bring these things out. Now, let's do that whole passage, and I want you to add the pedal in the left hand. What's the most important voice in the musical texture in these opening measures? The melody, definitely. What's the next most important after that? So the left hand is sort of interesting. I mean, this is sort of classic middle ground material if you're a composer. So it has a little bit of interest, sort of hints of a counter melody here and there. But the bass line is just pretty static. So harmonically, it's important. Compositionally, not so interesting. But can you shape the left hand to the right hand melody? So really focus on doing everything with the right hand that we just did, but keep the left hand synchronized to it. Okay, let's try it. So you can lay your left hand down here and we'll just use the accordion by itself. Stretch and hold. Good. Yeah, we can stop there for a second. Okay, that was very good, and you did a good job of keeping everything we talked about in the right hand and not losing that when you added the rest of the texture. So just always, in this piece especially, think of what's important, what's the foreground. Focus on shaping the other elements to that so that you don't lose that. Now, third measure right here in the pedal. We were talking about the cello or the double bass for this passage and that part. How would you have them play? Ah, I love it. Yeah, that's exactly what I would do if I was arranging this. So pizzicato for those. Bum, 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 bum. And, you know, I think with this piece and with Franck's music in general, it's important to realize that he is not in the Vidor Guillemont tradition. So we often have this thought that all French music is going to kind of work the Dupré way, where you have, like, you know, strict rules for handing staccato notes and repeated notes and all of that. Franck is a little more freewheeling. Remember, he was a pianist first before an organist, but also a very skilled orchestrator and composer. So for me, I often find that thinking orchestrally and instrumentally can be a really effective way of getting the right sound for these. So can we take just the pedal line there, Sarah? And rather than thinking of this as a really strict eighth note or even like a staccato note or something, just experiment a little bit and see if you can make it sound like a cello pizzicato would sound in here. Good. Those notes seem a little long to me. If it's a pizzicato, I think like bum, bum, bum. So trust the decay in the room. Just try a shorter note. Let the room take care of the rest. You might try a little more ankle motion just to get some detachment here. You see, so I'm resting my foot on the pedal before I start, but then there's a bit of a rebound. Yeah, I think that's getting there. So let's try this passage again. And I don't want you to lose sight of the right hand, but see if you can get that pizzicato kind of sound on the pedal. Just the third measure. Yeah, make sure you start with the G. There you go. Bom. Bom. Yeah, good. So a lot of these same figures repeat in this piece. So my idea is we're really focusing on these first four measures, but you can take a lot of this stuff and apply it elsewhere. The last thing I want to look at with you real quick is right here, at the end of this section, is the poco rallentato in the off-tempo. I think you can lean into this a lot more. And you have, again, this sort of melodic repetition. So let's start right here, shall we? And you can play the full texture there. Espressivo. Now, could I suggest, I like the way you did the espressivo there. You may not want to slow down quite so much just because you have this poco rallentando in the next measure. So you're sort of giving the game away a little early if it sounds like it's slowing down. So, but we need to make the espressivo different. And remember, this is another repeated figure, so I think he's being intentional. Something more like that. But did you hear how I brought out these notes? But it didn't get bogged down quite yet. Big stretch here from that B, the octave. So that little bit of over legato and stretching. Let's try it one more time. Just do the right hand. Different. Good. Big stretch. Oh, can you stretch the B more though? The low B. Oh, yeah. A little more retard in that last beat, though. You sort of started your retard, and then it leveled off. You got to keep slowing down gradually. Let's do just the last two beats. Yeah, so that's good. That was nice and proportional. And then after that, you're back to your off-tempo and everything. So again, work out the melody. Get it in your ears the way you want it. Then go back to playing the full texture and just make sure that you're shaping the pedal in the left hand to that. You find it easy. So, great job. Thank you. All right, and now we have Jordan Fisher with Bach Fantasia in G minor, BWV 542. And I think, Jordan, if you're okay with it for the sake of time, let's just play a portion of this. Okay. But I do want to get into some of the contrasting passages. Sure, yeah, if you're comfortable with that. All right. Why don't we stop there just for the sake of time? But yeah, great play. Good job. So how long have you been working on this? 3 weeks. Okay, so this is pretty new. Yeah. Have you played any other Bach preludes and fugues or major free pieces? Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. No. So you're. I mean, you've played some similar repertoire before. So that's always helpful. Yeah. Excellent. So for me, with this piece, first of all, I think so much of how these pieces work revolves around the idea of affect. You're familiar with this term, like the mood or the style or the emotion that might be reflected in not just an entire movement of a piece, but within different sections or even within kind of measure by measure within a piece. We might have different affects or emotions that are alluded to or suggested. And I think to play Bach expressively and well, you really have to become attuned to all of these things. So we just went through several contrasting sections of this piece. If I asked you to sort of suggest an affect for each of these sections, what comes to mind? Mm-hmm. So the opening, I think dark and fiery is a great way of describing this. So that second section, where you went to the second manual, what are some similar adjectives that you might use to describe the mood there? What are some adjectives that you would use to describe that section in the same way that you're describing the first section using other adjectives? Calm? Yeah. I think that's good. And then this next section, the last one you played. Yes, and so I think for this piece, as well as a lot of Bach's music in general, if you can figure out these sorts of contrasts, but attach them to something emotional, you know, it's like I like dark and fiery and angsty a lot more than just, oh, it sounds really intense. You know, it gives us a little bit more to go on in expressive terms. And I'll just say with this piece, the way that I often think about this movement, there's a couple of different things that are being worked out, but for me, it's sort of angsty through a lot of the piece, but it's sort of extroverted angst versus introverted angst. It's like, you know, think of like Hamlet, and it alternates between like, you know, why God, why, and it's like, why, right? So it's sort of the same, it's the same mood, but it's like two different facets of it, okay? So I find, for me personally, with this piece, that's a really helpful way of starting to wrap my mind around how some of these sections interact with each other and how they contrast with each other. Okay, so you don't necessarily have to think about it in those terms, but I really appreciate that you can already start to attach these ideas to this music. Yeah, I mean, call me Doubting Thomas, but when I see the nail holes, I believe those stories. You know what I mean? Yeah, so I mean, it can be hard. With some composers, certainly. I think with composers like Bach, except for very specific pieces, I would be careful connecting it to like specific historical things, unless there's a smoking gun, musicologically speaking. But you know, for us, just thinking about what these pieces mean, great. Let's go back to the beginning real quick. So our big goal is we want to bring out more of these emotions, but also start thinking about, you know, more specific points of interpretation here. I think the beginning of this piece is very much like a recitative. So you have like these very solid pillars, these chords that are happening, and they're all sort of expressing different facets of G minor, but very solid. Like if you were conducting this as a concerto, you might have your soloist over here, but you've got the orchestra and you're just going like, boom, boom. And they're going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, all the crazy stuff, okay? So you have to be a one-man orchestra and give us all of these different layers. So can we actually start with the pedal and the left hand And I want you to have this feeling of just absolute solidity in these chords. Ready? Yeah, just play it in the upper octave. Yeah, there you go. All right, here we go. And then what happens? It resolves, right? So you've got all of these chords, like very, very tense chords, but they're just sort of hanging out there unresolved. So that's one layer of what's going on here. Okay, so you have to listen for that, and that's the orchestra. Now, let's take the right-hand part. So this is like your soloist, the recit-like part. Have you played any French classical music, French Baroque music? Okay. But you know that Bach was strongly influenced, especially from the mid and later part of his career, by French practice, especially with things like ornamentation and so forth. So one important thing about the use of French ornamentation in the style is that the ornaments are understood to be integral to the melody. They're not optional. So for these sorts of pieces, and with early Bach, this is, you know, up for grabs, but I would say with later Bach, certainly, if there's an ornament that's written in, you should play it, because it's meant to be part of this longer melody. And so it's not sort of, oh, there's these 64th or 32nd notes here, and there's this ornament over here. It's more like this is one integrated long melody. So what ornament do you have on the very first note here? Good, mordant. Right. And I would actually extend this mordant a little bit just for the sake of the drama. Yeah. Yeah, good. Okay. Remember, in French practice, these little terminations at the end of the trill, in almost all cases, if there's a long trill before it, the trill just goes seamlessly into those notes. So you see, like, right here. Can you do that? Good. Now, so don't think of this as like, there's these four notes here, and then there's a trill, and then there's these three notes. It's just one long ornament. Yeah. But can you play it and see if you can just sort of smoothen it out so all of those elements blend together? Yeah, that's getting it. Now, for fingering, I would actually suggest, see if you can use your strongest fingers, 3 and 2, for the trill. It's going to give you more control. So start with your thumb on the F sharp. Yeah, did that feel more comfortable? Yeah, but as much as you can on these trills, use your strongest fingers, unless there's some good reason why you can't. But that was great already. So now we hear this long expressive melody here, as opposed to sort of trill, 32nd notes, and all that stuff. So can you take the right-hand part from the beginning? Let's do this whole measure going to the second measure. So longer mordant, more expressive. But do it with an F sharp, because we would definitely want the leading tone in that G minor. Yep. Yeah, take it a little bit slower. I know I'm asking you to do a lot, and you're doing a great job with it. So it sort of settles on that note, and now pick up into the next ornament. So. Okay. So you can work out the details there. I mean, these notes go by very fast. So what I would suggest you do is grab a pencil, or your Apple pencil, figure out where the eighth note subdivisions are in this. And I would go through and mark them specifically, because notationally, it's not always intuitive to see like where the actual beats are in this. But it's really important with this sort of stuff when you learn it metrically. Then put a metronome on with 16th notes, 8th notes, but some sort of small subdivision, and practice it very, very strictly. And then, once you know it inside and out strictly, then start to play it with the freedom and the expressivity. I find if you sort of jump into it and you're playing it very flexibly from the beginning, sometimes we may not internalize exactly where the beats are falling, where the stronger notes are going to be, and so forth. And it will go pretty fast by the time you're playing it up to tempo, but invest that time in the slow practice here, and it will really pay off for you. Okay? Does that make sense? But for these sections like this, where it's the free thing, I would, you know, practice very slowly, practice integrating the ornaments into the rest of the melodic line, and then only when you are absolutely solid on it, start to speed it up and start to play it more flexibly and expressively. Good. Let's look at that next section, shall we? So this is, can we go to the next page? We've got about 6 minutes here. So can we start here? And just for the sake of experimentation, could we try a different registration here? Okay, I would like to go with something that's more vocal and a little more introverted. You were using like the brighter registration with the 2 foot and all of that stuff. Let's go with something that's more just like a principle. So let me try this on the grade, and then we'll have. Think about this, like, have you sung any Renaissance music, like motets? But you've heard that sort of music, right? Think about this section kind of like that. All of these different voice parts just interweaving. It's certainly not in a Renaissance style, but think of it more like this really complicated, interesting polyphony. All of these different voices chiming in with each other. Okay, let's take it from the beginning of that section. So, do you hear like smaller phrases within this? So I mean, we can look at this section as being like 5 measures long, 5.5 measures long. But I think within this, there's these different points where maybe there's a shift of harmony, or there's a little bit of a at least slightly implied cadence, or the texture changes a little bit. So there's, you know, sort of resting points and then moments of more tension. Where do you hear those points in this? Mm-hmm. Could I suggest, let's try thinking of this as an arrival point, just harmonically speaking, because you've got this little resolution. And then the texture opens up a little bit, and the same theme re-enters in the tenor. So it's kind of like it restarts like it was right here. But let's start here. Can you play the pedal a little more, with the notes a little closer together, kind of like I was talking about with Trudy, just so it sounds a little more vocal? Okay, start here once more. Good, now right there. So that's going to be your resting point. Can I try it for a moment? So first of all, in the pedal, think of this more like basso continuo. So if I was coaching a group that was playing this, I would want like really nice expressive chord strokes from my cello. And right here, you have this great suspension on that beat. So I would have everybody really lean into that. Isn't that great?
Yeah,
and then it resolves. But you hear right there, so. That's the point where sort of melodically and harmonically things resolve just for a second. But then it keeps going and back into this complicated stuff. So can you treat this as an arrival point, lean into that dissonant harmony, but then go all the way with that phrase to where it resolves? Can you try just that much of it? We're going to start with this grinding dissonance. But you have to hear how that resolves itself just a beat later. Let's start right here. Let me give it that measure. Try it. Can you take that note in the left hand like you have marked it? I think that's what you have. Try taking the D and the E flat, or just the E flat in your left hand to make the fingering easier. Same place. Good. good. Yeah. So now, can you lean into that first beat a little bit? And then right here, just feel like it's relaxing. And wait a second before you go on, okay? Because then this section kind of restarts right here with that tenor entrance. So just think of how we might sing the soprano line there. I'm sort of trying to imply this diminuendo there, so it relaxes. And then it intensifies again once the tenor re-enters. Does that make sense? Yeah. Try it once more here. I'm going to sing with you. Wait. Yes, so right there, just hold on just a second. Listen for the tenor. That was good. I like the way that you leaned into that, and then it just sort of relaxed. Let's do it once more. Good. Beautiful. Same thing. Yes, good. So that already brings this section to life. So now, rather than just hearing this kind of weird harmonic progression that continues through it, now we're really starting to hear these interesting melodic bits, these amazing harmonic suspensions and dissonances that are started up, and it becomes much more expressive. And I think that's in line with what we talked about initially, which is how do we bring out these different emotions? So, you know, working out those ornaments and like the fieriness and the angstiness of that opening section is counterbalanced by what we're doing here, where it's almost gentle, but very expressive, you know, very vocal, really in tune with all of these dissonances and everything that's going on. So it's giving you what you want emotionally, right? The two sides of these coins. So anyway, so a lot of this stuff you can continue to apply through the rest of the piece. Many of these things continue, but hopefully this will give you a good start on it. So yeah, thank you for your good work on this. Great. All right, let's have a final round of applause for our three performers today. All right, and thank you all for your time. I know there's another session in here in 15 minutes, but if you have any questions or want to talk further, I'll stick around for a few minutes. So thank you again.
Thank you for listening in to this recorded session from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Institute on Liturgy, Preaching, and Church Music. We hope you'll join us at one of our conferences in the future. Visit lcms.org/worship-institute for more information. lcms.org/worship-institute.